Hello all, welcome to the God Said It Was podcast. I'm Patrick Barney, one of the editors of Kai Draconis Books. Kai Draconis Books is an anarchist independent press that publishes socially engaged literature. If you'd like to check out what we're doing and get a free book, go to xidraconis.org and you can see what we're all about. With me, as usual, are the other editors of Kai Draconis Books, Chris Malmberg and Hans Berger. Today we are going to talk about Haruki Murakami's 1Q84, a giant novel that is intriguing, weird, disturbing, and macabre, even. I have a lot I want to talk about this novel, but you know, Chris, it was your pick, so I think we should start with what you're interested in talking about, and you know, I'll be sure to bring up my concerns as we move forward.
Sure, I'll do a quick summary basically for the people who haven't read it, or it's been a while.
Or the people who started it and only got 50 pages in.
Right.
Which I think is about 60% of everyone who approaches this novel.
Yeah, it's very, very slow in the beginning. But, okay, if you guys don't think a summary is necessary.
No, I mean, I would do it. I'd give an overview.
Yeah, well, and I think part of what's notable about this novel is you probably will be able to summarize it rather quickly, even though it is 1,200 pages or 43 hours of audiobook. So,
yeah.
Yeah, so we...
Less sort of, that if you listen to it at double speed, which I had to do.
Yeah.
Go on.
And it's really weird with Alvin and the Chipmunks reading for Al Mame and Tango. No,
well, the readers were super slow, so putting it at double speed, you know, my ears got used to it really quickly, actually. Anyway, enough interruptions. Go on, buddy.
So we have two main characters. Al Mame they're both 29 years old, which is important because they went to school together and lost track of each other in fifth grade, but had a moment where they connected that kind of resonates throughout the rest of their lives and throughout the book entirely. One of them is Al Mame. She is a fitness trainer and sort of obsessive, they're both obsessives in their own way. I think a lot of Murakami's characters are obsessives, but she's very obsessive about her health and fitness. And she is a fitness trainer who moonlights as an assassin who is not really in it for the money, but is basically killing men who are abusive to women. And Tango, the male half of this binary, is he's a teacher who is writing but hasn't really found his own voice, hasn't really published anything, but it has a close relationship with an agent who basically seeks him out to help him work on a novel, basically clean up a novel written by another important character, Fuka Iri, who escaped from, ran away from a sort of a cult, and basically it wrote a story about that cult. And so Tango and Fuka Iri clean up that book together. It goes on to become an important work in society. It's sort of picked up by the press and people are talking about it, which is sort of dangerous because it makes the cult aware of them, and they are somewhat targets. They are targets because they are telling these sort of secrets, I guess. Meanwhile, Al Mame, the woman, main character, is made aware that leader, the sort of like head of this cult, is sexually abusing prepubescent girls. And so kind of at a sort of a climax of the a sort of a middle climax of the book, there is this sort of two things happening at once. Fuka-eri and Tengo are having sex, and Aomame murders Leader. And then sort of following that, there is this like long kind of like decreasing orbit where like Aomame and Tengo are brought closer and closer together, and end up together at the end. And kind of interlaced throughout this are like very bizarre magical realist moments, some things that feel to me like they might be symbols, but I'm not exactly sure how to map them onto what they're intending to signify or symbolize cleanly. There's a lot of themes of groupthink, what happens to the individual when the individual is sort of absorbed into a cult-like atmosphere, the power of storytelling, and love. Love is a really important thing in this book. And lots of weird sex, very weird sex. So how does that work for you guys? Is there anything that you would flesh out? There's some, definitely some weird peculiarities here and there.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I think the only thing I'd add to the synopsis is, on the night that Aomame kills Leader and Tengo has sex with Fuka-eri, Aomame becomes somehow pregnant with Tengo's child,
yes.
Because Fuka-eri is sort of acting as this transmitter, receptacle and transmitter. And they, at the end of the novel, the novel takes place in sort of an alternate reality where there are two moons, and Tengo and Aomame have kind of landed in this alternate reality at the beginning of the book, and at the end of the book they leave the alternate reality and come back into the more commonly understood one moon universe with Aomame pregnant with Tengo's child.
Yep.
And also some weird homunculi come out of dead people's bodies.
Also a dead goat.
A dead goat and a dead man's, they come out on two separate occasions, of once on a through a dead goat's mouth and the other through a dead man's
well
mouth.
That's a question I have for you guys. Is it worthwhile to sort of to think about the so like the homunculi? There are little people who first appear, at least in the timeline given to us in the book, by crawling out of the corpse of a goat. But they are later shown to crawl out of the mouths of a couple of the characters while they sleep.
Aomame's mouth.
Aomame's,
once.
I think the little girl, the other little girl who runs away from the cult too, I think.
What was her name?
Oh man.
Is that how the dog got burst apart?
Yeah.
Tsubasa.
Yes. Maybe they come out of her mouth, and can't quite remember. But
and yeah, I think they. I don't think they. Yeah, they burst the dog apart in pursuit of Tsubasa, but I don't. I'm not sure we have a real clear idea how they burst the dog.
Yeah,
they just burst
the dog.
Yeah.
But they
Yeah, that's one thing about this novel so much is like it's not a fantasy novel in the sense where like he's world building. like it seems closer to magical realism where crazy things happen and there's no explanation.
But do those crazy things map onto something that we like? Do they map onto something that can help us sort of make sense of them, or are they just sort of crazy things? Like, are the little people representative of something? Is the distinction between a Maza and a Dota representative of anything? Is that just a dead end, and not very useful to talk about? Or that was kind of a question that I had for you guys. And I think that even if they are sort of not something that is valuable to talk about, I think it's interesting to talk about what they then are from a stylistic point of view. So.
Well, I'm not sure about Maza and Dota, but at least as far as the little people are concerned, they crop up as a kind of okay, so this idea of balance comes up right before Almame kills Leader. Leader brings up this idea that the balance between good and evil is important, right?
Yes.
So we have that idea seems to be echoed in the idea of the little people insofar as the little people is brought up as a kind of refraction or inversion of the idea of George Orwell's Big Brother. So, like that was one idea I definitely wanted to talk about because, like it seems at least on the surface it seems a little shallow, right? Like he brings up the idea of Big Brother, and then we have the little people who are like somehow the opposite of Big Brother, but I'm not sure exactly. Like it just seems like a res like. A play on words, and I'm not sure that like there's a thematic resonance there. So I don't know. I feel like there's something going on with this idea of little people, but I'm not sure what it is.
Yeah, I mean, well, and more broadly, I don't know that the connections to Orwell, personally, I did not find the connections to Orwell to be particularly illuminating or particularly effective, or
Me
like
neither. I
what
didn't
I
think they were
mean,
super good.
they just kind of seem incidental, right? They seem to me
Right.
more like a stylistic detail, and maybe something that would be more, maybe if I were Japanese and I were reading this novel in Japanese, they would seem, maybe they'd be a little bit less obvious for, cultural reasons or things that have to do with the translation, and they would be, maybe because they were less obvious, they'd be either more rewarding to find, or it would seem less like there was, like they had to be doing work or carrying weight that they're not doing. And I don't know. I mean, to your question, Chris, about the how much any of the magical realist elements are symbolically, how much they do symbolically. My urge is definitely not to, personally, my urge is to not read them symbolically, right? And I mean, I've read a fair amount of Murakami, and I'm gonna try not to talk about other Murakami novels or, Murakami generally, because I do want to focus just on this, but like, the sense I usually have of Murakami, and maybe this is a limited way of reading, right? Like maybe I'm underestimating Murakami or not giving his work enough attention. But the assumption that I've developed about Murakami is that the emotion, the core thing in terms of the core thematic interest is the emotional lives of the characters, right? And that the emotional lives of the characters and the sense of them trying to steer away from sinister potentials, and the things that you might call surreal or magical realism that happen in any of his novels are, they have a kind of intuitive logic, but the point of their intuitive logic is less to symbolically make a point about something particular than to provide a path or a vessel through which the characters can live out their emotional arcs. Does that make sense? and that the artistic virtue of them, that the artistic virtue of Murakami's use of magical realism or surrealism is that the progression of events has a certain kind of hidden dream logic that's effective because it seems kind of intuitive and maybe a bit ramshackle, and that the effectiveness of it lies in its ability to sort of make instinctive sense without being able to be churned over into objective sense. And so you're chasing a dead end if you try to come up with like an X equals Y sort of symbolic resonance, like you might with a different author. I don't know that, and that's not always 100% true, right? But the examples I can think of where I have read some amount of symbolic resonance into what Murakami's done, they tend to be other works, right? Like some of his stuff, maybe there's a bit more symbolism in the magical realism, but that's rare. For the most part, it's just kind of this, like, things happen so that the characters can live out their emotional arcs.
I think I generally agree about, I think, and that's part of like what is sort of bewitching and at the same time frustrating about Murakami is.
Yeah, and I think it's probably an easier tendency to tolerate in the context of like a 300-page novel than a 1,200-page novel. But sorry, didn't
no, and I did actually kind of get swept up in this book, even though this is the second time I sort of picked it up to read it and actually finished this time. I think that there's something about how he starts with characters who are extraordinarily self-aware, and this is also something that I find characteristic in my reading of Murakami. Mm. His characters speak about themselves in their heads with just extraordinary control. And so there's this lack of tension that you might find. And I've always wondered if that is, I don't know enough about Japanese writing to know if that is something that is a cultural difference or if it is stylistically something that Murakami has entirely, you know, to himself. But these characters are kind of in control of themselves, at least apparently, at the very beginning. It's sort of like starting a painting with only a few primary colors and with big strokes that don't really portray anything more than I'm in the mind of a young woman, I'm in the mind of a young man, and somehow from there sort of, I don't know, kind of he definitely charts some kind of path that their emotional state takes from, in my opinion, and you feel free to disagree with me. I'm trying to remember why it is. I was trying to think of why it was that I quit 1Q84, and what I kind of understand from his other works, it always seems like his characters start from a state of just almost a complete lack of tension, or maybe a lack of anything really interesting going on, even when, in this case, a character is killing somebody in the very first chapter of the book. It is, it's always controlled. And from there, somehow we find ourselves in a state of tension. But it takes a while to get there. And it seems proportional to his other books because it takes a long time to get there in this particular case. At least it did for me. But maybe that doesn't make any sense to you guys.
It does.
I did. Oh, go ahead.
I mean, I think you're right that... Well, I was just going to say the arc from disengagement to engagement, right? The arc from apathy to engagement is certainly very typical of Murakami's work. I mean, that's kind of his most basic, that's one of the, it's a very fundamental arc, a very fundamental idea that shows up again and again and again in his writing. And you're right. I guess that's an interesting point to make in this case, right? Because, like you said, both of these characters actually start out with very interesting things happening to them that they're somehow unmoved by. That's an interesting point.
I will say, while I tend to agree about, I think it's in Kafka on the Shore, fish fall out of the sky, and Wind Up Bird Chronicle has several examples, that a lot of these very striking moments of magical realism that seem to sort of encourage upon the real world, while I do tend to think of those as sort of random, and random might not be the right word, there might be a better word for it, I did in 1Q84 feel like the little people and the Maza and the Dota meant something. I felt like the distinctions between receiver and perceiver meant something. And I kind of gravitated toward a very simplistic reading of them that I think in the moment I liked, and then looking back on it feels too simple. Basically, and this might speak to like little people being, you know, like being sort of drawn in opposition to Big Brother in 1984, but aren't the little people like aren't they the superego? Aren't they kind of this sort of manifestation of, because I think they're also referred to as the voices, or you know, like leader is sort of important because he channels the voices. And we are dealing with this sort of shard communion that is a cult, basically, a xenophobic cult, and then they have these manifestations of little people and voices that seem to be important to that cult, to that cult's understanding of itself, and we're told that they're powerful. And And I don't know, it's not a very clean connection, but I felt like that the little people were sort of a manifestation of the narrative and the narratives that, I guess, like, bound the cult together, brought Aomame into the story through Tango's own novel. I don't know. It's not clean, but that's where my head went. I guess it's not as simple as I thought. I thought it, like, thinking about it, it seemed simpler, but now verbalizing it, it doesn't.
What aspects of the little people seem to you like?
Well, I guess it's the Maza and the Dota, right? Too, because like the little people are constructing a Dota, right? Of Fuka-iri in the story, that she writes. What's it called? Something Chrysalis? Air Chrysalis. In her story that she writes, which is an account of her experiences in this cult. The little people crawl out of the corpse of a goat that she is responsible or somewhat responsible for letting die. And punishment in this community, this intentional community, is basically this sort of like 10 days basically forced isolation. And she's forced to be isolated with this goat. The little people emerge from the goat. The little people weave an air chrysalis, and another Fuka-iri, a copy of herself, emerges from the air chrysalis. And what that made me think of was the construction of a second identity that is basically a zombie-like I mean, it is like a zombie image, right? It's a
Well, like the Fuka Eri that Tango has a relationship is the
That's not
Dota,
clear.
right?
He suspects so, yeah.
He suspects
But
so.
yes.
But she's the one who's like a zombie. We assume that the Fuka Eri that stayed in the compound is the real one
Maza.
that is not zombie-like, and this one is yeah, that one's the Maza. This one's the Dota who is
Yes.
zombie-like.
Yeah. And
Right?
so I
Okay.
guess like the
So go on.
construction of the way that these little people manifest out of like a goat feels vaguely, even a dead goat, like there's something kind of ritualistic and something kind of ritualistic and fundamental about the punishment that Fuka Eddie receives and the body of the goat and the way in which something manifests from that experience that basically creates a cult personality. You know, like a it is a you know, if you were to sort of take the physical manifestations of the little people away, this is the experience that turns her into that basically indoctrinates her, right? So like this is the thing that creates that second self out of a whole person that is really just subject to this narrative that's whose sole function is to transmit the voices of the little people. And so I guess like superego is where I went because of
So,
Japanese culture as well, the my understanding being these more powerful, not necessarily like Big Brother in Japan, might not map as cleanly as, you know, not necessarily a centralized power, but more
the
a decentralized narrative that is the superego that would be kind of controlling and directing people.
Hmm, that's interesting.
That's an interesting point to me, especially because it resonates actually more than I would have expected with
Right. Oh, yeah.
French Lieutenant's Woman, right? Because one of the things that struck me in reading French Lieutenant's Woman was that, like I've said a few times, it was about a form of totalitarianism that came from both. Partly from widespread social scrutiny, right? And then also from the installation in people of very, very firm sort of self-reproach and
Right.
self-control. And your suggestion here seems to be that a similar form of combined social scrutiny and self-reproach and self-control is actually the form of totalitarianism that is perhaps a form of totalitarianism that the people in the novel or that in Murakami's perception, a lot of Japanese people are living under.
And that is a fairly close reflection of 1984 and George Orwell, like the
It's
idea of bi
an inversion of 1984. Where the power of where totalitarian power comes from inward through self-scrutiny and control rather than outward from brute force.
Right, but the inward reproach or self-control, which is like, you know, the Foucauldian panopticon or whatever, that's only achievable because there is actually someone watching you. Like or at least the potential that someone could be watching you at any time. So I'm not sure I agree with the inversion idea. Like it's more
Yeah,
like
that may have been overstated.
It's more like a the next step. So like in 1984 we have a world of where everyone is being watched and everyone lives in the fear of being watched and everyone thus you know that self-reproach is a necessary or natural conclusion of that. That if you live in fear of being watched or being outed or for dissent or whatever, then you know, inside you, you're gonna respond to that. Now, of course, so Orwell's idea is that there's not actually a place that is free. Like, the characters in the novel think that inside of themselves they're free, and that there are ways to have free thought. But of course, Orwell says, you know, that's what's horrible about this situation. You know, there actually isn't. They can get you wherever you are. So it's not. Maybe inversion's not the right word, but it's not exactly the same, I suppose.
Different, but the result is similar.
Rather than
a centralized power coordinating these things, the power that is moving, that is sort of shifting the sort of repressive control that manifests in each of us, is fantastical and ultimately not something we could ever understand. You know, it comes from another world, mm-hmm. And is ultimately, I mean, like the probably the most clarity, I guess, if we are going to treat this as something that could be mined for any information, the most we get is from Leader, you know, before Haumame kills him. And, you know, Hans, I think it was you or Patrick, mentioned balance. There is this sort of, this idea that the forces are pretty indifferent to individual people, to what we want. It's not even clear that they want anything. Only that they act, you know, and they act through us. Like, we are vectors for their function. This may be totally silly, but like, I thought about receiver and perceiver, and my mind actually went to an audio receiver, because I couldn't quite think of, like, what does receiver and perceiver mean? Is this also just sort of noise? But like, if we think about an audio receiver, the function, you know, like the function of a stereo receiver is to amplify. And that made more sense to me. Mm-hmm. I still don't know what to do with perceiver, but in the context of what it seemed to be that Leader and Tango, who were identified as receivers, right? Perceivers.
No, they're
Fuke. Okay, Fuke-eri is a receiver. Right? Maybe we don't go down that path. I don't know exactly what receiver and perceiver mean.
Well, no, I like this metaphor. Let's think about it. So Fuke-eri and the other, you know,
Tsubasa
chamber maidens with whom Leader has an ambiguous congress.
Yeah, that's interesting to talk about as well.
They're receivers. Yeah, I definitely want to talk about that. They're receivers, so they act like an antenna that draws all the frequencies in, right? That captures the frequencies. However, none of that frequency means anything unless you filter it out with your frequency
or your penis, right?
on your
in this case, unfortunately.
right. So maybe Fuke-eri is the antenna that captures the frequency, and then Tango and Leader are the frequency knob, where you select a specific frequency to see if anything meaningful is coming on that channel. But of course, there's nothing in the novel that actually bears that out that I know of. Like,
these ideas are all, this is all really, this is all very these ideas, these interpretations are all really interesting and really thought-provoking. And I keep thinking... Yeah,
that they mean nothing.
Well, it's not that they don't mean anything necessarily. It's like there's no... Maybe the term for it is objective correlative in the novel, right? Like we're talking about... You know, we're talking here about like these ideas about repression and control and totalitarianism, and unless maybe I was inattentive or inadequate as a reader, but there's like a force that idea has that's not necessarily borne out by. I love that interpretation, except that reading the novel, I just fundamentally don't feel like I'm.
No,
observing people who are living with any unusual amount of, I don't know, like it. There's a kind of drama in these interpretations that isn't really supported by the dramatic weight of what really happens in the novel.
Right. I absolutely agree with you.
I have very strongly mixed feelings about this novel. Right. Like I did have an easy time reading it. I mean, I've been making jokes at the expense of its length. But I actually didn't find it difficult at all to get through.
Yeah, and I mean, it's actually pretty enjoyable on just as a read.
It is. And many of the characters are very appealing, but there's also something that just seems... There's also something about it that just seems faint and ridiculous.
Fundamentally opaque.
And these interpretations are great, but they're not... Yeah, these interpretations are too heavy for the actual text.
What is the heaviest narrative? What is the heaviest element in this book, as established by sort of dramatic and narrative weight? Is it love? Is it the romance between? What's
emptiness?
Emptiness. Yeah.
Emptiness, hollowness, nothingness. That's what I would say. Right. I mean, you have. And to some extent, this reading is a little bit influenced by having read other Murakami, right? But like, the theory, I guess, I kind of like going into my second reading of this, because it was a reread for me. I had this general theory of Murakami that I had established, right, which is that, like. And maybe if he were to hear this, I would be getting this all wrong. But like the theory of Murakami that I've kind of developed is that like after Japan lost World War II, they had to sever themselves from a lot of what had been their culture and from a lot of their history, right? And the result of that was that you have this kind of you have this society that is. On the surface, thriving and bustling and an economic powerhouse, or was until, you know, recently. And if you kind of peel back, there's nothing under that, right? It's this thriving, bustling society full of these very empty, hollow people. And there are two ways that manifests, right? One of those is that all Murakami's protagonists are, they're apathetic, they're disengaged, they have great ennui, they don't care. And the other thing the other danger of that is that this hollowness creates an opening for sinister forces to rush into very easily, right? Whether that's, you know, and Wind Up Bird Chronicle maybe portrays that more effectively, right? Because in Wind Up Bird Chronicle there's this idea that what the protagonist is basically fighting against in Wind Up Bird Chronicle is the resurgence of creeping fascism, right? This kind of neo-fascism that's not really even based in anything. It's like a neo-fascism based in empty sophistry.
That seems to resonate.
Well, and frankly, I think Wind Up Bird Chronicle is a much more effective work than 1Q84. And in 1Q84, there's not the antagonists are just the antagonistic forces just aren't compelling in the same way, right? The ennui is compelling though, and if you think about like Tengo's father, right? Tengo's father is somebody who collects for a state media company called the NHK, right? His job is just to go around and knock on people's doors and say, hey, you're watching public television, so you owe me a little bit of money that I can then give back to the people who make the the TV that you watch, right? And that job, that fundamentally kind of empty, meaningless job, that is the entirety of his identity, right?
Mm.
And there's a kind of horror in that. Maybe the most, to me, the most effective horror in the novel is actually, it's this character who it lives so completely and fully in this very basic pedestrian empty identity, right? And there's a kind of running side thread of the plot where when Tengo's father, the NHA collector, when he's in a coma, his spirit begins going around knocking on people's doors and harassing them, right? And those sequences, to me, read in a very sinister... They're sinister and scary in a way that a lot of the other stuff, like the little people and the leader and the cults, didn't really resonate as much. And so the... To me, that... on that idea of emptiness, of hollowness, of kind of living a sterile reality with the awareness that there's sort of an empty void at the center of you, that was... Even though that's not, even though maybe that's a marginal thematic concern in a large work with a lot of stuff going on, that felt to me like the weightiest thing.
It's interesting. I read that completely differently.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I didn't see horror in it. I saw like, I mean, definitely he. I kind of looked at him as, to me, it made him more empathetic. Like he's, this is the only method by which he has to have any type of meaning in the world. And right. I absolutely agree. Yeah. It's objectively shallow, you know, like getting money for NHK, but like to the point that he tries to show his son, like he tries so hard to share this meaning with his son, that it creates a rift between them. He's so dedicated to this, and nothing what I'm saying is necessarily like saying that you're wrong. I don't think that you are. I just I didn't focus on the horror so much as thinking, you know, oh, this man who has, he has this one thing, and you know, it's so important to him that his spirit goes out to continue to try to do it. So I guess,
yeah.
Your reaction was horror, and my reaction was empathy, which I think is strange.
Well, I don't necessarily think that those things are totally. Depending on how you frame them, I don't think they're mutually exclusive.
Yeah, they're definitely not. I agree. They're not mutually exclusive at all.
I was going to change the direction of the...
No, you go ahead.
I thought I perceived a gap, but I was wrong. So you go ahead.
Oh, well, and maybe the thing I'm going ahead with is just grinding on the same idea, right? But I mean, maybe part of where the sense of horror came from for me was the way that the NHK collector role requires him to be so manipulative and loathsome and to kind of employ. And maybe this goes back a little bit to some of the ideas that you guys were talking about that I kind of said the novel wasn't supporting. Maybe I was too quick to make that judgment, right? Because the way that when Tengo's father does his NHA collection, the fundamentally the lever that he's using to do that is public shame, right? He picks one person and he stands outside their door and he loudly broadcasts to the whole apartment, "You are being a deadbeat. It's embarrassing. You should be ashamed of yourself." And with the idea that shaming this one person will then make everybody else in the apartment go, everybody else in the building think, okay, like I don't want that guy to do that to me because I'm going to be, you know, publicly humiliated in the same way. So I'm just going to pay him so he goes away as soon as possible. And I mean, maybe that's a convincing illustration of some of the kinds of quasi-dystopian social control that we were talking about? Or maybe I'm reading too much into
it. Well, I mean, you know, to kind of circle back to something that Chris said earlier, and I forget what you said, but you were talking about, like, the precision...
There's self-awareness.
...of the characters, I'm not sure.
Their self-awareness? Yeah, the self-awareness. The precision of their self-awareness.
So, when you said that, it reminded me that this, to me, felt like a very Japanese cultural icon. I have read some other Japanese novelists, like Yasunari Kawabata, and I'm a big Akira Kurosawa fan. So, to me, much of this novel feels very, very characteristic of how Japanese people view themselves and how they speak to one another. I'm not that Murakami's vision is the same as Kurosawa's or anything like that, but the way that they speak to one another and inhabit their world is very similar. So, that to me seems reflective of what you were just talking about, Hans, where Tango's father is trying to publicly shame people, because culturally shame is huge in Japanese culture. You know, it's a very big thing that has, you know, historical, you know, that has century old roots in the country, right? Where you know, shame and losing face are huge motivators, are huge drivers mm-hmm. of behavior. So I would say that does actually strike me as reflective of what Chris's postulation that maybe there's some kind of criticism of social indoctrination and social control.
Criticism as far as acknowledging its existence and some of the ways that it can hurt people, but also
right
not really positing any alternative. You know, like, this is just
right
kind of the way things are,
kind of like how Frank Herbert and Dune is just like, yeah, there's no way out of fascism.
I was wondering, could we talk a little bit about the treatment of women in this novel? Yeah.
Oh, I think this is super important. I definitely want to talk about this.
Yeah.
An explicit attempt to give voice to women, especially like in regards to sex, to give them agency and control over sex. And at the same time, there's a really problematic sort of treatment of the book acknowledges the victimization of women, the abuse of women, and then really muddies the waters in a potentially interesting, potentially terrible, potentially, I mean, I don't know, at least something we could talk about, way when it comes to sexual abuse. We should definitely talk about women in this.
Okay,
he gives women agency, specifically Aomame and her friend Ayumi, agency over their own sexual escapades, at least to a point. Ayumi is actually murdered by an unknown man that she hooks up with. Then there is the situation where Leader is having sex with underage girls, and that idea of abuse is established very clearly early on, and then muddied by this idea of that sex not being real sex, which is really, and like, it depends on how much we're willing to sort of trust leader who, while he's sort of like saying these things, is occupying a kind of an omniscient space. Like basically, like leader is given this before Amame kills him. He is basically positioned as someone who knows everything, and then is really complicating what we understand to be sexual abuse at the same time, which is a very interesting way of potentially making it's very hard, I guess, to write about sexual abuse and not have it be, you know, very easily vilified by the reader. But then we're led to wonder if what is going on is not as simple, which I don't know. Like, what is that something worth talking about? Or,
well,
yeah, I think you're right that it seems like the context in which the novel frames sexual abuse kind of strips it of any ability to actually act as any kind of commentary on the fact of sexual abuse in the world, right? I mean, the sexual abuse, basically, like what Leader says is, well, I go into a trance and I can't move my body, and then they climb on me and have sex with me. And that's like, and I mean, given that exactly that happens to Tango, I feel like it's plausible to take Leader's word for that actually being how he experiences that event. So yeah, I don't know, like I think that like what Murakami does with female, the sexual agency of the female adult characters is probably, there's maybe more there to think about and talk about than what he's doing with the you know, violation of underage girls, just because the way that the violation of underage girls is actually used in the plot has this kind of like the use of the aspect of magical realism kind of drains it of any,
to the extent that when
drains it of
Tango
gravity
and
it would normally
Bukiri
have, maybe
do have sex, he doesn't impregnate her, he impregnates Almame, where it's basically physically not sex, like the
right.
So you're saying it's just to the way that what is happening in the novel maps onto anything real is too complicated, too messy, too absurd.
It's too absurd.
Well, Patrick,
I think, I don't know, maybe you guys feel differently.
Well, it's not, no, I agree with you. I think that, like, initially, we see things from Almame's point of view, and, you know, it's easy to feel, you know, some, you know, like, you know, she kills this oil magnate guy who's, like, abusing his wife or something. Sure, fucking kill him. Sounds great. But then when we get to Leader, that's complicated. And because, though I think that Leader's situation is different from Tango's, in that Leader, like, let's say that having sex with underage girls is wrong. Let's just say that. Let's take that
right,
as
we'll
our
establish that.
We'll establish that. But if he has no control over it, then he doesn't bear any responsibility, except that he doesn't leave the compound. So I guess there's an argument to be made that he does have responsibility insofar as maybe he can't control the action of having sex with these underage girls, but he can control whether or not he stays in the compound, and he chooses to stay in the compound. So maybe so it's complicated, but it seems like he still would have some responsibility. And then when we get to Tango, it's like he has no control over it all, and, you know, he doesn't stay in the situation, so maybe that's not problematic. Though I do think I feel like we definitely need to talk about whether or not Murakami's depiction of a 17-year-old girl, you know, he says that it wasn't sex, but but also refers to like her perfect
breasts. Is this old male writer writing about sex?
Yeah, you know, so I feel like
is this sort of just destined for all 60-plus-year-old male writers to just sort of slowly?
I actually went so far. I went so far personally because I wasn't totally sure. Like, well, the unfortunate thing is that okay. This novel required me to Google age of consent in Japan, which probably
because
I was thinking, I don't know, like, because if it were.
Your wife's a feminist, dude. She's going to find that shit out. She's going to know
about it. As absurd as it sort of is, right? Like, if this were an American writer and that character were 18, it would be sleazy, but not...
Yeah.
There would be... It would just be different somehow in how we were supposed to...
Yeah, we'd just be reading about Al Pacino or something.
Sort of sleazy and unpleasant, but not completely outré. Like,
right.
Right, yeah. And so... But I mean, it. She's for all intents and purposes, yes, like culturally slightly underage in Japan still. Yeah.
Right.
But I mean, I don't know, and I don't know if the fixation that Murakami, like Tengo, does have a fixation on Fukaeri's body, right?
Yeah.
And I don't know to what extent that reads as unpleasant or problematic
Can it read as authentic and
I mean it you know if you're
well no authentic and meaningless like it is
problematic.
the physical response is something that it would be silly to not, you know, acknowledge that, you know, like, you know, but the ultimately,
right.
Their
That's
relationship is not sexual in any way. Like, she's not a sexual being, even if she looks like she is. And so, even though they
right.
do,
well, she's a copy.
Yeah,
I mean, she's ultimately not a full-fledged human being.
Right.
Right. But again, that. The, you know, I think again the metaphoric or thematic resonance, like you have a novel where the protagonist has sex with a teenager who is then revealed to that it's okay that, you know, he has sex with the teenager and then it turns out it's okay because she's not a full-fledged human being and it was a mystical act, right? And that seems like it should mean something. But I'm not ultimately convinced that it does, right? That it really kind of carries any symbolic or thematic weight. And there, it just seems like there's a kind of writerly laziness about throwing all that stuff around the way that he does and just not doing more with it. And again, maybe I'm underestimating or underrating something that's happening or missing something.
So you think it's laziness? Like the problematic things that crop up in this novel... You know, the
well, I think we should probably, or at least I feel like it's worth distinguishing between, even though we've kind of lumped them both under treatment of women, it seems like the stuff to be said about how Aomame experiences sex and her sexuality, I think that's different interpretively from the ways that sex with underage girls as a mystical kind of mystical accident is employed, right? Even though those feel like they might be objectionable in similar ways, I do think that there's much more. It just seems like the Aomame's sexuality and her experience of sex feels like it's supposed to be thematically resonant in a way that the teenager sex is not.
Mm. Right, no. I thought that the depiction of Aomame as a sexual person, I didn't have much problem with that. That seemed okay to me. It was It was mostly the, because, you know, I, you know, it's hilarious. Like, she wakes up one morning after, like, getting kind of crazy and her butt hurts, and she's like, oh, shit, did they do it there, too? You know, that was funny,
right,
and
right.
I didn't think that was problematic. It was mostly his depiction of Fuka Erty that I found kind of pervy. You know, but it's borderline, because she is 17, and a part of me wanted, like, Tango and Fuka Erty to get together.
Like, we keep
so
on talking about
maybe
her
I'm
as,
just the perv.
We keep on talking about her as sort of, like, right on the verge of being in her majority or whatever we want to call it, but, like, that's sort of, like, there is this... I'm definitely willing to believe, like, narrative laziness, actually, when it comes to some aspects. Tsubasa, leaders sort of like basically arguing that he's not having sex with a person, he's having sex with a concept. I think that there's like a lot of, you know, late night pot smoking we could do and just sort of like basically like blow that up, but like it doesn't really, there's not really anything outside of that one claim. And, you know,
that didn't make sense to me, this idea of having sex with a concept.
It seems flesh and blood
to me.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, and I don't...
Well...
I don't know that it's even supposed to make sense, you know?
I was just going to say, it is interesting
fundamentally,
that Fuka Erty...
Sorry, go ahead, Chris.
...is this sort of example of someone who is... in a liminal space between childhood and adulthood, isn't really a person, is beautiful and apathetic about her beauty, where we still, I'm not sure about like the inclination in criticism to just sort of like talk about how like, oh, the writer's implicating us. You know, like, I don't know. Like, that seems also kind of stupid. But it does, you know, I think we can all be kind of implicated together. But, like, it's weird that, like, all of these things do complicate enough where, you know, we're not sure if something wrong happened. Or, I don't know, like, and we don't know what to do about it. And
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Tango sure didn't want to tell Almana at the end, though. He's like, I'll tell you later.
Yeah. No, that's.
I'll tell you how I impregnated you later, hon.
it is, and there is kind of a reflection. It's not just Tango. Like, they're using her Fuka Erty's beauty to sell these books. Like, that's, like, explicit. You know, like, they're. You know, so. There is an acknowledgement of the how I think there's an acknowledgement that this is objectification, at least, and that objectification is easier in a way because she's not a person. She almost is an object. And I don't know where to take that, but
That's interesting. There's a deeper layer there than I initially gave it credit for. But hearing you talk about it, Chris, I think it's
well,
maybe less
maybe it
problematic
still is though.
On,
I mean, like
it,
he could be writing
her
that way
thought.
As a way to just sort of allow himself to write about her that way. You know, I really enjoyed the Aomame Ayumi scenes. I thought,
I was super bummed when Ayumi died. I was hoping
ultimately
she would stay throughout.
I can't help but wonder if like a 60-plus-year-old sexually frustrated writer with, you know, you talk about googling the age of consent. Hans, I googled Murakami to see if he had an interesting shaped head. You know, I was like, Are you just hoping to run into no, not
Like
Uchikawa, but like
he's
the type of guy
Ushikawa.
that Aomame looks for. You know, are you is he just hoping to run into this girl? Like,
Oh,
you know,
like
there was something. I can never, and I still don't know. And I love his collection of short stories, The Elephant Vanishes. It's one of my favorites. And I really enjoyed Kafka on the Shore.
yeah.
I liked Wound Up Bird Chronicle less. Hard-Boiled Wonderland was okay. It wasn't my favorite, but like, I can never tell if what I'm seeing is simply what it is, or if there's something underneath it. And I almost feel like Murakami, for me, like the enjoyment I get out of him is the sense of uncertainty that I have th that things might be more meaningful than they actually are. And you can kind of exist perpetually in that space. And I don't know, like I wish that I think I keep reading Murakami novels, hoping that I'll read one where it's like, yes, it's true. Things are more meaningful than they actually are. But then they never get there.
See, that was actually my experience with Wind Up Bird Chronicle, right? Like, Wind Up Bird Chronicle felt to me like the one thing I've read of his where there's really something there. There's really something being said. There's the parts kind of fit together in a way that just kind of has some heft that a lot of his other stuff doesn't. And I mean, I think that that sense of uncertainty that you describe about is there something there or isn't there, right? I do think that that is characteristic of a lot of his work, but for me it kind of leads to a sense of diminishing return. And I think to some extent, I really feel like the ranking, like if you take any given person's, and maybe, you know, if any Murakami fans listen to the podcast, they'll disagree with me. But my sense is that if you take any given person who likes Murakami and you have them rank their like favorite to least favorite Murakami, it's going to be closely aligned with which ones they read first. There's kind of a sense of surprise. There's a sense of surprise attached to his overall thing that diminishes and diminishes and diminishes once you've experienced more than one or two of his books. He's very, I mean, he's more repetitive in terms of character type, in terms of emotional arc of his characters, in terms of he's probably the most repetitive. Like of all the authors in the world who are like really taken seriously as literary writers, he's maybe the single most repetitive that I've personally encountered.
Sounds a lot like Stanislaw Lem, actually. I've read s I r I remember reading Solaris and thinking, "Oh man, this is fantastic. I should read more by this guy." But he just does the same thing over and over again. Yeah, pretty much every novel. It's like, yeah, we can't communicate with one another, and we never will be able to. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, in the interests of, you know, not going on and on and on at length, do we have any closing ideas that we want to talk
I think
about?
I think we don't know. Go ahead, Hans.
You know, well, I was just gonna say the you mentioned the indeterminacy about whether or not there's. You mentioned, Chris, the indeterminacy about whether or not it means anything, or whether or not there's underlying meaning that we're missing. There is kind of an interesting indeterminacy for me with this novel, maybe more so than any other Murakami, where I can't quite tell if it's. I can't tell if I'm really fond of it,
Oh
or if
man,
I sort
yeah,
of
I'm
think
right
it's
there.
terrible, right? Like, I definitely didn't mind reading it, and there are some things about it that I think of with great fondness, and yet the more that I kind of really dig into the components and think about it, the more I'm able to kind of find a lot of different avenues to disrespect it. Mm. And I don't know, it sits in a very interesting liminal space that way. And that's true of, I think, all of Murakami's work for me, but it's maybe most true of this one.
Yeah, I don't have anything more. Murakami continues to occupy a space that is itself sort of mysterious. I feel like he has created a avatar of his own style in my sort of in the schema that I've created for him in my mind, where I don't know, he fascinates me and I don't know what to do about it or with it. I do know that, like, I've read his collection The Elephant Vanishes several times, and that I think that, like, maybe in tight form, that relationship between, I guess we didn't get to this, but, like, I feel like postmodernity might be especially interesting in Japanese culture. Basically the severance from traditionally held beliefs and structures of meaning is particularly powerful in the place where the bomb fell, you know. So in a place that was weirdly potentially the most one of the more a culture that had taken traditionalist values and basically refracted them whole into a modern infrastructure and a modern way of life up to and beyond World War II.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, they were a world power and, you know, still operating with a lot of the things that that other parts of the world had discarded, that had moved into, you know, the global, you know, nuclear age. And I don't know exactly, you know, Hans, you mentioned, you know, that emptiness. And I think, like, one of my teachers who taught Murakami, I read him a couple times in a couple different classes, one of them who taught Murakami basically made the case that all of Murakami's stories were about the bomb. I think that that's interesting, and I don't know what to do with it, and that leads me back to the same place all over again. So maybe it's all just a bullshit magic trick.
Yeah.
It probably is.
It might be.
All right.
Just saying.
No, that was Patrick's turn.
It might be. So Chris, is it? No, it's Patrick's pick next week.
So, As I've said before, we're gonna do Where We Land, by Daryl Farmer. And I've already talked to Daryl, and I've set up a tentative date with him for March 29th. I can't do it 2 weeks from today because I've already got plans on March 22nd. So hopefully March 29th, the Sunday of March 29th, is good for you guys. If it's not, let me know, and I'll get back to Daryl, because I did say it was tentative, so.
Sounds good.
Yeah. That's the deal. Where We Land.
All right. Well, I'll talk to you gentlemen then.
Stories of the West. All right. Peace out, gentlemen. As always, good to talk to you. And dear listeners, I hope you enjoyed this podcast episode of The God Cetibus. Catch you next time. Peace out.